Well, welcome to the second lecture in the Darwin College lecture series on the theme of life. When I introduced the series last Friday, I said that one of the things we were interested in formulating the series was the limits of life, the boundaries of, if you like, life and non-life, before life, after life, and how life and death intermingle. And tonight, the disciplinary background, if you like to put it that way, is literature. And I suppose we're concerned with the material remnants of life. The subject is life in ruins. Our speaker is Robert McFarlane, who's a fellow of Emmanuel College and teaches in the English faculty here at Cambridge. He was educated here at Cambridge and at Oxford, and he's, in a remarkably short time, become a writer of some substantial stature. I'm sure many of you will have read his book, Mountains of the Mind, which combined the study of shifting aesthetic perceptions of mountains with what, to me, were the rather scary insights he gave into the motivations of being a really hardcore mountaineer. And then there's a book called The Wild Places, in which he communicated his enthusiasm or exaltation, perhaps, in the experience of solitude in the relatively remote spots of the British Isles. He's also written about originality in the 19th century, and there's a book coming out in June with Penguin Books called The Old Ways, which is about travel through life and through space on old routes. And he's won lots of prizes and lots of awards and made television programs from his books and so on. It's a great pleasure and privilege to invite Robert McFarlane to talk about life in ruins.
Master, thank you for that introduction, a very generous introduction from which it can only be downhill, I fear. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I start this lecture as promised. I think you all have a synopsis in front of you. Is that correct? Yes. So as promised, or perhaps as threatened in that synopsis, we're going to begin with a thought experiment which involves you all. Those in the front rows, relax. You're not going to be summoned up, blindfolded, spun around thrice, and asked to recall embarrassing childhood incidents. It involves you only in the sense that it implicates you. It has implications for you, because the thought experiment goes a bit like this. I'd like you to imagine, first of all, the disappearance of humans from the Earth. We're eliminated in this scenario, my scenario, very neatly. We don't go by means of a devastating nuclear war, but by a Homo sapiens-specific virus. It deletes us swiftly, but it leaves our built environment intact, and it leaves the ecologies of which we are part undisturbed, other than by our absence. And I want you to imagine, in fact, that the planet's last inhabitant, it may be any one of you here, dies about now, about 5:30 p.m. on the 27th of January, 2012. So what would happen to this world without us, in Alan Weisman's famous phrase? Or rather, for the more precise purposes of my thought experiment, what would happen to Cambridge without us? How would our city alter over the days and weeks and months and years and decades and centuries that would follow our evacuation? So here's our first image. It's a tourist brochure aerial view of the city centre at its most manicured and ordered. But because I'm here not to praise Cambridge but to bury it, I've really supplied it the better to help you imagine the city's destruction. Though I'm quite attracted, I must say, by the proleptic hint of things to come, these trees that are encircling the city and waiting for their chance to move in. We'll keep this image in view, and I'll hypothecate then for you a set of futures for this post-human Cambridge of ours. Well, first and fastest would come the hungry fungi, even at this cold time of year. Inside your houses, through the coming February, mold blooms on the food left out on sideboards and worktops. It blooms on your corpses as well, but that's the last mention I'm going to make of those. With no one to chase it away, dust settles in the windless interiors of your lounges and your bedrooms. Decay has started, but so, in its way, has stasis. In March, a late spell of winter is cast. Water freezes in pipes, and the thaw brings floods. Ceilings crash down, walls fatten, soffit boards rupture. Fire follows in the summer of 2012, lightning strikes, gas explosions. I'm forgetting about Sizewell, that's beyond the realm of Cambridge for this thought experiment. These leave cratered holes and husked houses. There is plenty of paper fuel in Cambridge, of course, all those libraries, all that research, whose only function now is as superb tinder. A college burns to the ground. I speak entirely impartially as a fellow of Emmanuel when I suggest Trinity for this fate. And in the way of these things, it very unfortunately takes all of St. John's with it as well. And by August, Rose Bay willow herb, which, as some of you will know, is also known as bombweed because it thrives on carbon-rich soil, flowers on these blackened sites like a pink floral fire. Out on the streets of Cambridge in the first couple of years after our departure, the situation is volatile. Asphalt and paving are cracked by freeze-thaw cycles. Soil blows into the fissures, plants take root. Sycamore seedlings pry up slabs and shift curb edges. Bindweed laces the spokes of many rusting bicycles. Jays bury acorn by the thousands in those manicured quads and lawns. Aggressive species such as buddleia proliferate on walls, their roots powerful enough to crack bricks when thirsting down for water. Buildings and thoroughfares are slowly torn apart by flora. Weeds disassemble our city into a tipsy chaos. 3 or 4 years on, various guerrilla ecologies are pretty well established by now. We've got the escapees from domestic gardens. We've got snowberries, cotoneaster, conifers. They're doing fine. Japanese knotweed, Japanese anemones, these guys are having a great time of it. They're running riot. In the swimming pools of Cambridge, the outdoor swimming pools at Christ's, Emmanuel, Clare Hall, the water is thickened with leaf debris. It's mulching darkly down. It won't be long before these are miniature fens. Blackthorn, which, as many of you will know, used to cover large areas of the southeast, marches out of the hedges, suckering rapidly along. And elm, too, works out in small thickets, keeping its head down because Dutch elm disease hasn't gone away. A soil cap deepens on the tarmac. It's low in nutrients, therefore it's highly biodiverse. Clover, grass, wildflowers, even orchids thrive there. 5 years. A pair of peregrines is breeding in the Cherry Hinton chalk pit, another on the university library tower. Owl populations boom. They're happy. There are plenty of nest sites in ruined buildings. The mice are happy too, so the owls are even happier. Muntjac and roe deer wander over Silver Street Bridge, occasionally predated on by the two snow leopards escaped from Linton Zoo. Their names are Lamo and Centurio, incidentally, but there's no one around to call them by their names. And any ecologists in the audience, please forgive me the snow leopard whimsy, although they might actually do fine. The city's flood defences, of course, we're a watery city, but we keep our water in good order, but no longer because we're not there to do it. Sluices and bridges have blocked with debris. The river's begun to explore the possible extents of its domain. Cofen, Lammasland, they're flooded. Good news for little egrets, good news for herons, and for Phragmites reeds. Chetty's warblers are heard within earshot of Peterhouse for the first time in decades, singing out of the vast stands of pink Himalayan balsam that bully the rest of the riverbank flora. There's no agricultural nitrate runoff, so the cam's now clear and oligotrophic. Its pike are more abundant and larger in size. The American crayfish completes its invasion of our waterways. Mink and otter, no longer depleted by traps and by cars, the two main killers, rise in number. Over the course of a century, on the drier ground, grass gives way to thistle, which gives way to a scrub of hawthorn and elder, which in turn gives way to a forest that now grows extensively through the city, comprising sycamores, ash, oak, beeches, hazel, and lime. It's a return of sorts to the pre-Atlantic period wildwood that once covered the southeast of England. And on Parker's piece, the grass rises high and then falls back as a heathland emerges through which adder's slide. And so within 500 years, nature's reclamation project is almost complete. Little that is recognizable of today's Cambridge is still visible. The city has been wilded. The famous buildings are mostly rubble, enjungled like Mayan ruins. Our open spaces are now forest or fen, but they're browsed by large herbivores, maybe the conic ponies from Wicken or the Highland cattle from Wandlebury, which do keep glades open between the trees. Of course, human residue remains, even that long after we've vanished. What will survive of us is love, wrote Philip Larkin, but actually what will survive of us is plastic. When archaeologists from other planets come to analyze the late Anthropocene, what they're going to find in our middens is not clamshells and nutshells like those of our Mesolithic forebears, but bleach bottles and ice cream tubs. And this is how my counterfactual ends. On a summer's day 1,000 years hence, a warm wind trundles an empty, labelless plastic Coke bottle past what was once Great St. Mary's Church, chasing it between trees and saplings until at last the bottle gets snared in weeds, hard up against the pale and the prostrate masonry of King's College Chapel. So, thought experiment over, though in a way this whole lecture is about thought experiments. As any ecologist will tell you, ruins offer niches for species. Their combination of shelter and exposure, their broken material textures, provide ideal footholds for weeds and wildflowers. And as any cultural historian will tell you, ruins also offer niches for narrative, their disrupted structures, their resonant allusions to collapsed pasts and dreamed of futures provide ideal footholds for writers and for artists, those weedy species who have for centuries now been drawn to ruins as sites peculiarly generative of story and of trope. It is possible indeed to construct a long and near continuous cultural history of what I'm going to call ruinism. I'm just going to use that as a shorthand for the art and literature of ruins. And that cultural history might run from ancient Rome through to the present day. There would be obvious peaks of interest during the Renaissance, during Romanticism, and really sustained peak, which I guess would be a plateau, therefore, over the past 150 years or so. And within that ruinist tradition, there has been a conspicuous preoccupation with nature's compensatory resurgence in a context of human wreckage. And that is the idea of life in ruins, which is my subject tonight, in both of its senses. This preoccupation with life in ruins, with natural resurgence, has often taken the form of an apocalyptic pastoral, in which, as in my own opening scenario, ruins induce green-minded and sometimes troublingly misanthropic fantasies about humanity's large-scale depletion and nature's large-scale return. We might trace the roots of this apocalyptic pastoral back, for example, to the instance I give on your synopsis, 7th century BC, arguably, the Book of Zephaniah, which very relishingly warns that after the destruction of Nineveh, the desert owl and the screech owl shall lodge on its capitals, the raven croak on its thresholds. Well, all of these scenarios, however brief or long, arise from the fact that, as Georg Simmel, who was a theorist of modernity, put it in 1911, a ruin is an artificial object sliding towards an organic state. And these scenarios that interest me, they all imaginatively follow that slide forwards to the point that artifice is all but abolished and the organic all but triumphant. And that slide is what I will be discussing this evening. I am interested in the ways that writers and artists since the mid-19th century particularly have imagined the future ruin of the human world and how they've conjured the role of nature within those ruins. The lecture is consciously composed of fragments in the sense of brief engagements with different works. There is no arching, bracing single thesis, but I hope also that wreathing through those fragments are certain ideas of life, life in the form of nature, but also towards the end of the lecture, the second half will be about the poet Edward Thomas, who some of you will have an acquaintance with already. It'll be about life in the form of human creativity in a context of ruin. I want also to think about some of the imaginative dangers of ruinism, and they include misanthropy. We've already seen tinges and flickers of that. They include also voyeurism and nostalgia. And I want also to think about some of the conceptual paradoxes that aggregate around ruins and ruinism, in particular the idea that ruins might be somehow constructive, or more precisely put, that speculative art about future ruins might help us better to inhabit our own present and possibly to choose more wisely between our own available futures. Let me start my exploration with what I would guess to be one of the best known images of ruinist art. Sorry, I thought I was crimping my microphone there. I'll unfold my arms. This is Gustave Doré's 1872 engraving entitled The New Zealander. Who is our New Zealander? Well, he's an invention of Thomas Babington Macaulay, who conceived of him in an 1840 review essay warning against Whig presumptions about the glorious continuity of English Protestantism. This is what Macaulay rather sonorously concluded in his essay. The Roman Catholic Church may still exist in undiminished vigor when some traveler from New Zealand shall, in the midst of a vast solitude, take his stand on a broken arch of London Bridge to sketch the ruin of St. Paul's. Well, it may have been a tossed-off trope, but it had a remarkable afterlife. It proved to be something of a meme, this New Zealander of Macaulay's. By 1867, in fact, the New Zealander had become so ubiquitous that Punch magazine was moved to issue an editorial banning its use on grounds of hackneedness. Doré, like me, had proved deaf to their entreaty because only 5 years later, and here we are back to it, he includes it in these images that he publishes together as London, a Pilgrimage. And Doré's engraving has itself since become iconic, arguably to the point of hackneyed. There sits the New Zealander with his sketchbook looking across to Commercial Wharf. You might be able to see the lettering there just on the edge of the frame. The symbol of the city and its former lifebloods of finance and trade, well, it's now redundant on the burst banks of the Thames. Above the wharf rise ruins, and up to it surges life in the form of the trees. There are shades of Piranesi, of course, that perennial ruin artist whose influence, like that of Caspar David Friedrich, persists to the present day. I mentioned voyeurism earlier, and it's strong here. I think it's worth noting because these aspects are common to much of what might rather tendentiously be called romantic ruinism. There sits our witness. He's safe on his side of the river. He's no war-racked refugee fleeing a broken city. Nope, he's well-clothed, he's well-equipped, and these ruins are issuing him not with a challenge to survival, but a prompt to cogitation. And we, of course, serve here as second-order voyeurs. We watch the watcher. We're able to wallow safely in the spectacular pathos of this scene. And voyeurism is one of the two most frequent criticisms leveled at ruinist art as a tradition. I guess the other is that of nostalgia or conservatism. And that criticism proposes that actual ruins are always drawing us backwards in time, and imaginary future ruins are often made emblematic, as they are here in Doré, of state institutions, the church, the city, which by being mourned in advance are implicitly affirmed in the present. And the ruinist imagination by this argument of both artist and audience is inevitably passive regressive. Well, maybe. But over the past century and a half, ruins have come increasingly to be understood not as nostalgic sites, but rather as complicatedly forward-looking. And in fiction, in sculpture, in painting, in film, the anticipation of a ruinous end has frequently served as a narrative means by which, or rather from which, we might return and make better sense of our freshly estranged present. Ruins have been pressed into service both to diagnose and to warn, and I think the most charismatic recent example of that comes in Cormac McCarthy's extraordinary 2007 novel, The Road. It's set, and here's a screen grab from it, it's set in a future America. This is the slightly unsatisfactory film version directed by John Hillaby. Unsatisfactory only in that it's an unfilmable novel, or that the novel achieved so perfectly in its own form what it set out to do that there was really no point in translating it into another medium. It's a future America. There's been an unspecified catastrophe. It's arguably anthropogenic in origin. It's charred the landscape to cinders and to ash. And through this terrain wander a father and a son. They're ailing, they're all but hopeless. Their story is told in a language itself scorched back to residue, in a rubble of verbless sentences and disjuncted paragraphs. And actually, in this scenario, nature, and in that sense, life feels very distant, arguably lost, arguably beyond retrieval. And in some sense, that is where the power of the novel to warn us exists. Bill McKibben, the environmentalist and writer, has spoken about how we need to feel environmental crisis in our guts, is his phrase, before we'll actually do anything about it. And that's, I think, that ability to make us feel in our guts is one of the reasons that McCarthy's novel has been acclaimed, as it has, as, quote, possibly the most important environmental book ever written. Read it, keep the lights on, keep your loved ones near you, but do read it. So in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, ruinism tightened as a cultural fascination. In the late 20th and early 21st centuries, it has approached an obsession and has therefore also often condensed as kitsch. Brian Dillon, who's a very good contemporary writer on ruins, puts it in this way. Late modernity has experienced what appears to be a distinct flourishing in the realms of global events, popular culture, and the work of artists, of images of catastrophe and decay. I want now to trace the lines of one such late modern flourishing. Let's start with Max Ernst, a canvas some of you will recognize. A surrealist painter, if that label is helpful to us here, painted in this case after Ernst had escaped internment in France twice. This is, as you can see, called The Eye of Silence, thought to have been completed in early 1944. We are looking at what appears to be an enjungled former city. The debris of this canvas is part masonry, but also, I think, part ossuary. There are bones glimpsable under there. And there are, too, these signature humanoid figures that we associate with Ernst. They're erotically tendrilled, draped with lianas. Those images that we can see appear to have been smothered rather than salved by the return of the vegetation here. He makes a similar, though less verdant, vision of this in a slightly earlier image, Europe After the Rain 2. Clearly the rain here is the rain of bombs delivered by Allied Naxis planes upon the cities of Europe. This is a rubble born of war. And again, it's not clear what role nature's return is playing here. Is it collaborating with the extinction of the human presences? Well, it seems to be enforcing a kind of mutation upon them. There are birdmen and tree people emerging. And these hybrid figures, human figures, which are often the only survivors in these apocalyptic visions, well, they recur as a trope after Ernst. And one of the places they slightly unexpectedly recur is in Japanese anime, which, as those of you who have any acquaintance with the filmography will know, is preoccupied with environmental damage, is often set in the future, particularly the work of Miyazaki and the Studio Ghibli films, which often occur in a forested future world in which a few humans are trying to work out a moral scape for themselves. But these are these very Ernstian figures in one of Miyazaki's camp followers, Sugiyama, from 2007. And this is another screen grab from the same film. You can see that these tropes recurring of shattered, in this case, industrial ruin and the return of greenery. Ernst paintings themselves turn up in the work of J.G. Ballard. In 1962, he publishes The Drowned World. It's set in the future after climate change has resulted in massive sea level rise, the tropical vegetation of great swathes of the globe. And Ballard, there's a rather lovely moment where Ballard writes that, as it were, unwitnessed on the walls of an abandoned apartment in the middle of one of these new jungles, the canvases, he writes, of one of Max Ernst's self-devouring, phantasmagoric jungles screamed silently to itself. Gulp. Well, 4 years later, he publishes The Crystal World, and this is the mass market paperback edition, and as you can see, it wears one of Ernst's images, a detail from The Eye of Silence as its cover. And that book's conceit is audacious. Deep in the African jungles, the world starts to crystallize. It's a very peculiar and beautiful form of ruin, and this bejeweled dream forest begins to move outwards from its jungular epicenter. And Ballard's crystallizations themselves recur in a very recent and I think very brilliant example of ruinist art. This is one of the opening images from Roger Hjorns' 2008 installation or sculpture, I don't know quite what to call it, but its title anyway is Seizure. And Hjorns, some of you will know it, he arranged for 75,000 liters of copper sulfate solution to be pumped into this abandoned and disintegrating council flat in a low-rise housing development in Elephant and Castle. This was the result. This is what happens when you enter through the ruined hallway, and then you step into this space, and then you encounter this close up. It's a disturbing, even menacing precipitation, a spiky modernist supermold that suggests decay first accelerated and then halted. And the work is, as I say, I think exceptional, this witchily beautiful bedizening of a former dwelling. It doesn't allow, unlike some of the more kitsch manifestations of ruinism, it doesn't allow an easy reading. There's no soft voyeurism here. It's too conceptually and indeed ocularly prickly for that. And the seizure of his title is obviously at once a physical spasm. It's the chemical action of precipitation, but it's also seizure in the sense of a compulsory purchase order or a bailiff's visit to evict a household unable to pay its bills. And in that sense, the work is contemporary in its engagement with the consequences of financial crisis. I mention that because our late modern ruinism has proliferated because, of course, late modern ruins have proliferated. As Ernst suggests, and as Leo Meller has documented in a very good recent book on the subject called Reading the Ruins, the Second World War made an actual ruinscape of much of Europe. Then, during the Cold War, nuclear conflict proposes to the imagination an apocalypse that was both sudden and plausible, a day's laying waste of a planet that had taken 3 billion years of life to develop. As the Cold War thawed, its often brutalist infrastructures became redundant. They fell first to abandonment and then, in many cases, to ruin. And even though the nuclear threat has receded, climate change continues, I think, to provoke further ruinous dreams and nightmares, though the change that it suggests to us is incremental rather than drastic. Christopher Woodward proposes, rather succinctly, he says, destruction, he's talking about the built environment now, destruction is of a different speed and scale. We construct more and bigger buildings than ever before, and we abandon them more quickly than ever before. For these reasons and for many others, our present is increasingly littered with the debris of the futures that our pasts have envisaged. Surely the locus classicus of this contemporary fascination is Detroit, the Motor City. It enjoyed early 20th century glory with architectural aspirations to Roman grandeur, then it experienced near total economic collapse. This is a still from the Lee Plaza Hotel, built in 1929, as you can see, derelict since the 1990s. And the abandoned heart of the city and many other areas of it have seen a return of nature. And his one of the many houses of this kind in the city. And it annually attracts now really thousands of ruined tourists who go on these slightly illegal urban exploration tours. And within that group of tourists, of course, it's mostly composed of photographers and filmmakers and artists and writers and other cultural gleaners in the debris, and they're attracted by the idea, as I am indeed, that Detroit offers a localized version of the world without us, a present-day future ruin. It's proleptically predicted there in Ballard, but we can actually walk into it ourselves. But these recording angels who go to Detroit in search of their angles, I think have paid really too little attention to the economic social circumstances that frame sites such as these. And this idea of the Detroit jungle has become so ubiquitous that, like Macaulay's New Zealander, but for rather different reasons, it's become disapproved of. And last year there was an article written denouncing the genre of ruin porn, named and shamed as visually exploitative and ethically insensitive. And I'm aware that I need to be careful myself, so I hope I'm keeping an edge of analysis to this rather than just gazing at it. There's another image, though. And I'm going to leave it there. Not the lecture, don't worry, you can't go yet, I'm afraid. But I do wonder what your reaction was. You can sit up slightly nervously at this point. As you listened to me at the beginning, hypothesize that post-human future for Cambridge. So, some of you may have been faintly affronted at the ease, maybe even the eagerness with which I eliminated the human species. But I suspect that many of you will have felt something akin to relief as you heard me describing the return of the wild to the city. For there is there not something misanthropically comforting in the notion of this post-human world, this temporary dallying in an environmentalist's deep green dream? By imagining our own erasure, we are temporarily absolved of our monstrous success as a species, forever out expanding our niche and bringing about, as we have, the sixth great extinction pulse in the Earth's history. It'll be all right in the end, certain such fantasies assure us. The planet will recover from its infestation of Homo sapiens. Well, I want to carry that notion of a consoling, chilly misanthropy back to the late 19th century now. It's 1885. It's 13 years after Doré's engraving, and it's the year in which the English naturalist and novelist Richard Jefferies publishes his strangest and, I think, in many ways best book, which is called After London or Wild England. It's a key text in the modern ruinist tradition, and in this novella, as a result of an unspecified catastrophe, the English landscape has been dramatically wilded. And this is how the book begins. I'll read it out for those of you who can't see the text clearly. The old men say their fathers told them that soon after the fields were left to themselves, a change began to be visible. It became green everywhere in the first spring after London ended, so that all the country looked alike. No fields, indeed, remained, for where the ground was dry, the thorns, briars, brambles, and saplings already mentioned filled the space, and these thickets and the young trees had converted most parts of the country into an immense forest. By the 30th year, there was not one single open place, the hills only excepted, where a man could walk, unless he followed the tracks of wild creatures or cut himself a path. Well, there are people in his novel, but not many of them. They haven't done very well during this period of scarification or vivification, depending on your perspective. There are these Mad Max-ish tribes of gypsies, quote, and bushmen, quote, who roam the revegetated land, and they're divided along ethnic as well as self-interested lines. But Jeffrey's book follows his lone hero, the rather clunkily named Sir Felix Aquila. And Felix crosses a vast inland lake, and he reaches at last a putrid swamp. And it takes him a little time to realize that this is the site of, quote, the deserted and utterly extinct city of London, now lying under his feet. R.I.P., says Jefferies. There is no reprieve granted to London. Aquila is there precisely to witness and authenticate the total devastation of the city. And the pleasure which Jefferies visits this annihilation upon human structures, and London in particular, is unmistakable, and it is disturbing to encounter. There are various biographical reasons we might suggest for why this was beyond his natural green-mindedness. He was a very fine naturalist writer, natural historian writer. At the time of writing After London, and indeed for many years before its composition, he'd been suffering from tuberculosis, and he again and again figures this disease to himself as a dust, a kind of a masonry dust that settles on him and indeed settles in him. It's very troubling and recurrent trope. It kills him 2 years later in 1887 at a young age. He held London responsible for that illness to some degree, and he also held it responsible for the destruction of wildlife in its environ as the capital expanded. Here's the cover of a 1905 edition of After London, and you'll see at once the visual allusion to Doré's New Zealander. As you'll be getting a feel for now, ruinists are a very reflexive bunch of artists. They're always alluding to and reusing bits of their predecessors and anticipating, in that sense, work to come. After London was hugely popular. It ran through many editions, and its influence was great. And among those it influenced was a writer never normally thought of as a ruinist. And this is Edward Thomas. This is Edward Thomas. And he's the man who's going to preoccupy me for the second half of the lecture. I have a particular interest in Thomas. I don't want to patronize your knowledge of Thomas at all, but let me imagine an acquaintance with Thomas as it might exist. It might be that he is the author if at all, that he is the author of such often anthologized poems as Adlestrop and as The Team's Head Brass. You might have come across them in anthologies at school, or you might have heard them read, as they are often requested on poetry programs on the radio. You might think of him as an elegist for rural England, a rural England that was disappearing even as he wrote. But he was much more than this. He was a novelist, he was a memoirist, he was a short storyist, a biographer, and he was a pioneering travel and nature writer. But he was most famously a poet, and his poetry led a very peculiar life. It was late. It was a very slim output, though arguably that slimness is a function of his early death rather than his creative limit. He wrote 142 poems in just over 2 years. He started very late in his life, in December 1914, and he wrote through to early 1917. And these were poems that changed the course of modern poetry. Ted Hughes famously says at one point, Edward Thomas is father to us all. Regardless of your opinion of Ted Hughes, the testimony, I think, speaks of Thomas's influence. These branch lines, as I say, are being followed still. And his poetry is now being understood. Some of you may know an excellent recent biography published of him by Matthew Hollis, which has just come out in the last year. We're starting to understand how very, very modern Thomas was, how he was diagnosing, partly because he was experiencing tensions, notably that between dwelling and migration, or at least transit, that would come to express themselves in more and more people, more and more acutely over the course of the 20th century. He was more interested in fragment, actually, than he was in integrity, and he was more interested in movement than he was in a kind of rural, traditional, conventional life. From a young age, Thomas was a naturalist. From a young age, he was a noticer. And from a young age, he was a ruinist. And these three talents converge in a very telling moment in a late essay on the 17th century antiquary, John Aubrey. Thomas starts it by praising Aubrey's talent for isolating telling details. And here it is, that detail about details. Hubert Aubrey would have noticed and entered in a book that the spring after the fire of London, all the ruins were overgrown with an herb or two, but especially with a yellow flower, Erica Laevis Neapolitana. Well, we might continue. Hubert Thomas would have noticed that Aubrey had noticed that overgrowing of ruins with that flame yellow flower. It speaks, this detail, of Thomas's persistent preoccupation with life in ruins. And if you read through some of the thousands, I mean, literally tens of thousands, actually, of pages of published prose, he destroyed himself, really, into a deep depression, partly because of his hackery. He got locked into an economic cycle of literary overproduction. He was an incredibly prolific reviewer, sometimes reviewing the same book for up to four different venues, which must have been pretty tough if he didn't like your book, but obviously a good thing if he did. So he was a very controlling cultural presence in literary London in the years running up to the First World War. But it made him deeply unhappy because, in some sense, he wanted to be a writer. I mean, the sources of his unhappiness are complex, but it was certainly to do with the workload that he was subjected to. He published thousands of pages. Again and again, we see him drawn back to dereliction, to a rumination on ruination. And actually, he had a professional engagement. He worked in the heritage industry for a while, and he worked on Welsh monuments. And the crumbled castles, these big, charismatic ruins of Swansea and elsewhere, they do pop up in his prose, but actually his ruins tend not to be the grand and singular dilapidations beloved of Romanticism. Actually, what his characteristic ruin is, he follows a modest country lane to an end, he finds a sintering barn or an abandoned farm or a crumbling chalk pit, and something about the texture of crumbling, of things falling to bits, clearly drew his eye very repeatedly, and we'll see how it did so under different circumstances later. Thomas wrote a biography of Jeffreys. He read After London at least once. He returned to its scenario of a wilded and largely dehumanized England repeatedly. I mean, I've counted 10 different moments in the course of his work where he returns to it at length, but And there are times when clearly he is involved in a version of misanthropy that we saw in Jeffreys. This is a very famous, arguably, passage from the South Country from 1909 by Thomas. "I like to think how easily nature will absorb London as she absorbed the mastodon, setting her spiders to spin the winding sheet and her worms to fill in the graves and her grass to cover it pitifully up, adding flowers as an unknown hand added them to the grave of Nero. I like to see the preliminaries of this toil where nature tries her hand at mossing the factory roof, rusting the deserted railway metals, sowing grass over the deserted platforms and flowers of Rose Bay on ruinous hearths and walls. It is a real satisfaction to see the long, narrowing wedge of irises that runs alongside and between the rails of the South Eastern and Chatham Railway, almost into the heart of London." Well, listen to how that last sentence takes pleasure in plunging that wedge of irises into the heart of London, a floral stake to kill a vampire. "I like to think, I like to see, it is a real satisfaction." You can hear there again the longing in Thomas's voice, this perturbing pleasure that he takes in imagining the end of humanity and the supremacy of nature. And grass here, as so often in ruinist literature, is the concealer and the healer. It greenly unwounds this damaged earth. You might also notice that attention he pays to present-day metonymies, miniature versions of future takeover, those glimpses of moss and floral growth on factory roofs and in railway sidings. Thomas was amazingly alert to them, and they were just beginning to register in the consciousness of modernist writers and artists. And they gave him little scrying glasses, really, into which he could peer and see possible post-human futures for this earth. But actually, I think Thomas is at his most interesting when he's least like Jeffreys, when he curves away from Jeffreys's apparently swerveless misanthropy. And I just think it seemed to Thomas too easy a solution. Abolish humanity, let nature thrive, and all our problems will be at an end. It was too absolute. It was too escapist for Thomas. I think he knew that we live with nature, that there is nowhere purely unnatural, nor anywhere purely natural. And the hardest and the best thinking that he undertook in his writing was about how we might, in our schemes and in our lives, come to some kind of agreement, convivial or otherwise, with nature. And you can see glimpses of this. There's a whole essay on chalk pits. I love this kind of stuff. I can see why some of you might not be so enamored of it. But anyway, it's a brilliant essay. And he actually uses the word misanthropy there. He talks about the dangers of the misanthropy that often accompany the admiration of works of men, he says, that rapidly become works of nature. As you can see him starting to pull away, here's a poem for you by him. Not for you, he didn't know that you existed, but it's one, I think, of his most intriguing ruined texts. It's a tiny poem, it's here in its entirety. It was written in March 1915. It's called, as you can see, A Tale. "There once the walls of the ruined cottage stood. The periwinkle crawls with flowers in its hair into the wood. In flowerless hours, never will the bank fail with everlasting flower on fragments of blue plates to tell the tale." And that's it. It appears to be a very simple poem about natural absorption of a human structure, the cottage in the wood that's poignantly memorialized by the flowers that now grow over its ruins and the plates that mark its site. But on closer inspection, it rapidly complicates. Most obviously, there's an uneasy relationship between the actual flowers, if that's what they are, the periwinkle, and the porcelain. The blue periwinkle seems somehow to have emerged out of the shattered crockery. Artifice has leapt to life. But it's also trying to escape the site of ruin rather than staying to commemorate it. The periwinkle crawls into the wood. Well, plants don't crawl because they don't have legs. They creep. We talk about creepers, but we don't talk about crawlers. It's an unsettling verb to encounter, especially when we read it back through. It's sinister, even, and the crawling periwinkle suggests, to me at least, a wounded creature or a wounded human seeking sylvan shelter in which to die. Nature doesn't serve in this poem either as a hopeful resurgent or as an assiduous archivist. The poem claims, or seems to claim, that the flower and the bank and the plates between them never fail to tell the tale. But actually, no tale is fully told here. Who lived in the cottage? What were their lives like? Why has the cottage fallen down? These are all the questions that the poem poses to us implicitly, but it goes no distance towards answering them. These aspects are left unrecorded, arguably unknown. The poem itself was also told in shards. The reader is left to perform a kind of partial reassembly, but reading operates, when we actually start to do it, as a pretty futile exercise in repair or reconstruction. There are extreme limits to it. And the poem as a whole dissents from Jeffrey's loving vision of floral return. It seems, if anything, to be imagining a time when periwinkle and cottage might have coexisted, rather than one trying to flee the scene and the other having collapsed. This is an indulgence on my part, really, but it's because I think it's one of the most moving sequences of any poetry I know. But it has imagistic rhyme with what I'm talking about. Thomas's image of the periwinkle crawling into the wood with flowers in its hair. Flowers in the hair of a flower? Well, I sort of see what he's doing there, but it anticipates the seventh part of David Jones's Great War poem, in parenthesis. Jones also served, as Thomas did, as you'll hear, on the Western Front. He published in 1937 a great long poem called In Parenthesis. And there's a section that's informally known as the Mamet's Wood section, after the wood in which the Royal Welsh Fusiliers were killed in such number during this First Battle of the Somme. Death comes in the form of the Queen of the Woods, and she garlands the soldiers in the wood. Each of them is given a different flower or plant in a slow motion sequence, and the giving of the plant is a sign of the arrival of death, and there's a visual pun on the blossoming that blood makes as the bullet strikes, though the poem very carefully doesn't harp on that. I'll just read it to you. The Queen of the Woods has cut bright boughs of various flowering. This is only a section from it. These knew her influential eyes. Her rewarding hands pluck for each their fragile prize. She speaks to each according to precedence. She knows what's due to this elect society. Her rewarding hands can pluck for each their fragile prize. She can choose 12 gentlemen. She knows who is most lord between the high trees and on the open down. Some she gives white berries, some she gives brown. Emile has a curious crown, it's made of golden saxifrage. Fatty wears a sweet briar, he will reign with her for 1,000 years. That swine Lilywhite has daisies to his chain, you'd hardly credit it. So it continues, and death continues her garlanding, and death comes to each of the gentlemen. It's astonishing, and is to some degree there in Thomas's poem. 4 months after he wrote A Tale, in July 1915, Thomas joined the army, though he was doubly acquitted of the obligation to enlist by being married and by being 36 years old. He joined the Artist Rifles as a gunnery officer, and he trained in England until, in December 1916, a call came round for volunteers to go out and serve with the batteries at the front. And again, Thomas chose danger. He joined 244 Siege Battery. He was co-commanding 150 men. And on the 29th of January 1917, he and his troops boarded the Mona Lisa, bound for Le Havre, and thence the front lines near Arras. In the 10 weeks he was at or near Arras, Thomas kept a remarkable war diary. This is its cover. It's held in Oxford and made magnificently available to anyone who wishes to view it virtually through their incredible project, archival project of photographing and documenting a huge amount of First World War literature. It's a Walker's back loop pocketbook. It's bound for protection in pigskin. In it, Thomas recorded impressions, which, had he lived, would surely have been the basis for more poems. He only writes about a few hundred words every day. They're dashed down, but these jottings provide an extraordinarily vivid record of his experiences out there. And among the things which we know from this diary preoccupied Thomas most during those 10 weeks was the relationship between life and ruin. I say that not as a conceit, I say that not to serve the purpose of my lecture, I say it because it's true. It's what he comes back to again and again. By the 6th of February, he was approaching the front lines proper. And I'll just see if I can point out for you. So this is, I've got a more magnified version later, but this is what he writes on the 6th of February. So they're moving up towards Arras. Suddenly at 7:30, we have to shift to Mendicore with our guns. I go on in lorry and choose billets, all in half-ruined barns. It's about the first, it's an early mention of ruin. He'd left behind the Kentish North Downs, which is where he was being trained, a continuous, a curvaceous landscape. The chalk downs were really his heartland, though he's much more associated with the South Downs. They consoled him, these places, but then he enters a realm of ruin. He reaches this warscape that is filled with rupture of many kinds. He billets in those half-ruined barns. He watches shrapnel bursts. He picks his way around cratered shell holes on the Arras Road. He was inhabiting, really, a future ruin, one of those places that we've seen imagined by Doré or by Jeffreys, but suddenly made terribly real and by human action. His friend and fellow soldier in the Artists' Rifles, Paul Nash, whose work many of you will know, who painted some of the best trenchscapes in the war, they show a landscape of ruin. And to Nash's eye, at least, there is no life left in this place at all. This is the acidly titled We Are Making a New World from 1918. You can see that blood-red reef of cloud. You can see that sharp sun, explosive in the sky, light beams as shrapnel slice, and the trees, which have been shorn of their debris and are no longer trees but timber. Thomas's work at the front was mostly as a watcher, as a noticer, and as a ruinist. His perilous job was to take up observation points, posts in ruined buildings. In one case, in a part-collapsed factory chimney, which was a desperately dangerous posting for him. And he then watched, he used his field glasses to examine what he called the snowy broken land at one point in the journal. He was trying to work out the location of German guns. He was also trying to track the fall of his own gunner's shells so they could adjust their calibrations. It was deeply dangerous work. It was vulnerable to collapse. It was vulnerable to shell fall, and it was vulnerable to snipers. Four shells nearly got me, coming and going, he says rather calmly, as though he's talking about the weather, in his journal of one day spent up the chimney. So at the front, he was working in ruins. Back behind the lines, he was living in ruins. And during time off, amazingly, he became something of a recreational ruin explorer. He wanders through shell-shattered houses in Arras, not that there was really any other kind at that point. He itemizes the things he finds in these dusty spaces. Quote, an engraved 1850 portrait hanging on wall high up without glass broken. Quote, crucifix, statuette, old chair with a garment laid across it. He started also, amazingly, to see through the optic of ruins. This is an magnified extract from late March, to my eye, one of the most extraordinary entries of the war diary, the language of which uncannily anticipates Ballard and Hjorn's. How beautiful, like a great crystal. Let me see if I can pick it up for you on, it's quite hard to read. How beautiful, like a great crystal sparkling and spangling, the light reflected from some glass, which is visible at certain places and times through a hole in cathedral wall, ruined cathedral. About the only thing not in ruins, in fact, seems to have been Thomas himself. The war oddly put him back together. It solved his depression, partly by supplying him with purpose and function and acquitting him of the need to produce the work that he'd felt so obligated to before the war. He left behind his family, incidentally, of course, three children and a wife who loved him as much as any wife could love anyone, I think, to a problematic degree for Thomas, in fact. He wasn't blithe about his circumstances. He wrote of ghastly ruins. He wrote of the difficulty of living among rubble and rubbish and filth. But he wasn't really drastically discomforted by this world. Part of that stability, it's clear, derived from his naturalist's awareness of the non-human life that persisted even in the ruin of the front and that Nash didn't see, and quite understandably so. So in February, the journal is full of this stuff. In February, he notes the hare, the partridges, the wild duck in fields southeast of guns. Black-headed buntings talk, 14th of February. Rooks caw, grass rustles on my helmet through trenches. He watches kestrels hovering in pairs, it reminds him of the South Downs. Then he notices that above the kestrels wheel four or five planes. His attuned ornithologist's ear, superb at species identification, picks out a chaffinch saying chink in the chestnut, partridges twanging in the fields, two owls in the garden at six. The shelling, he says, must have slaughtered many jackdaws, but it's made home for many more. He says that in March, and there's a pre-war essay, actually, in which he imagines Jeffrey's ruined London. And he says, actually, it would have been a much cheerier place because it would have provided homes for jackdaws. And in part, that's Thomas dissenting, again, from Jeffrey's glum vengefulness, but also it's this bizarre anticipation of a detail that then comes true. I find the war diary, as you'll be able to tell, a deeply moving document, partly because of its absolute lack of self-pity. I'm also fascinated by these compensatory incidents of noticing and narration. And it's clear in some complicated way that I won't be able to explain satisfactorily here that the integrity of attention was serving for Thomas as a stay against the disintegration of material circumstance. The resilience of nature, its readiness to go on, is taken as example and consolation by him. And these field note style diary jottings, they're broken in form, they're residue, but they're also in some sense surplus. They're fragments of concentration that actually are whole to him in some way at that time. We'll come on to this in a second. Actually, I'll go back so you can't read it. By late March, the first major Arras offensive was approaching. Thomas had been at or near the front for 6 weeks. Ruin and nature had moved so close to one another in his perceptions that they'd begun to merge. One of his last forward observation posts was in an old, dilapidating chalk pit. And he writes, there's a lovely letter that he writes to Helen saying, basically, you're not going to believe it. I'm in a chalk pit. It's like being in the South Downs again. He talks about the chalk warm on his back, the sun falling on his face. And obviously, this is a way of evading circumstance. That much is absolutely true, as anyone would. You thrive on memories of earlier loved places. You carry out a kind of transportation, the heli-lift, the evac that's never going to come for you. You do metaphorically and imaginatively. But he also was inhabiting the present moment very intensely and very fascinatingly. Another of his final OPs, observation posts, was in a ruin by a lilac tree looking out through a hedge. And he's looking with his binoculars, and a blackbird keeps kind of trotting in front of his binoculars. And you can see this merging of ruinscape and nature and life. He talks about when the Huns' guns fired above our heads and into Beaurain, the shells came over like starlings returning, 20 or 30 a minute. He sees what he calls a piece of burnt paper blown towards him over no man's land, but it turns out to be, quote, a bat shaken at last by shells from one of the last sheds in Ranville. Machine gun bullets snake along, hissing like little wormy serpents. Among the two final things that Thomas records, very tenderly records, in early April are a great burst, he means a shell burst, that stood up like a birch tree or a fountain. And then another detail, that the turf on the forward command dugout has, quote, begun to be fledged with fine green feathers of yarrow. And on the last page of the diary, he writes single lines of something a bit like poetry, shards of future poems, and I'll just read them to you because you won't be able to make them out. The light of the new moon and every star, and no more singing for the bird. They're discreet, I think. It's hard to tell. I never understood quite what was meant by God. The morning chill and clear hurts my skin while it delights my mind. Neuville in early morning with its flat, straight crest with trees and houses. The beauty of this silent, empty scene of no inhabitants and hid troops. But don't know why I could have cried and didn't. You can see he's added that in another pen. These were his last works, really. And in their fragmentariness, they are true ruin works, and they are also true expressions of life in ruins. They formally acknowledge, but they also resist the circumstances of their composition. And they put me in mind, in fact, of the final work of another combatant artist from a different war, Rex Whistler, the painter who took part in the Normandy advances after the D-Day landings. Shortly before he was killed on northern French soil, he pulled a pack of blue and red chalks from his battle dress pocket, and he scrawled a Madonna and child on the exposed wall of a shelled ruined church in northern France. And there's no visual record of this mural, just the elements of the story reassembled by memoirists and biographers. At dawn on 9th of April 1917, at Easter Monday, the First Battle of Arras began. The morning was a triumph for Thomas's gunners. The British batteries disabled almost all of the German heavy guns with their counter-battery fire, and their troops took ground. As the guns fell silent, the British soldiers emerged to shout and to dance. Thomas stepped from his dugout, then he leaned back into the doorway to fill and then light his clay pipe. But he'd only part-filled the pipe when a German shell fell near him, and the vacuum caused by its passing, not by its explosion, threw him hard to the earth, killing him, we think, though there is some debate about this, by pneumatic concussion. The consequence of that is that his body was whole and unmarked, and that beside it on the mud lay his clay pipe, unshattered. His war diary was recovered and returned to Helen, his wife, and the folds that you may have been noticing on these pages are thought to be the pressure ridges caused by the air blast of the shell that killed him. I find Thomas fascinating for many, many reasons, but most relevantly for this evening's lecture, because I take him to mark such an important moment in the history of ruinism. He begins to extricate himself from the misanthropic absolutisms of apocalyptic ruinists such as Jeffreys, and from the melancholic, nostalgic ruminations of romantic ruinists such as Doré. He is, or he begins to be, and might have become had he not been killed, a modern ruinist. He was compelled by ruins, but interested in neither in being cast nostalgically backwards nor hatefully forwards. He was interested in contemplating, and this is true of his wider writing as well, how the human and the natural might best coexist. And his writings on ruin are motivated by a rather nice phrase by Andreas Huyssen, who's a contemporary cultural theorist, by a remembrance of nature in all culture. Thomas knew that all our sites are sliding towards the organic, in Simmel's phrase from the start of the lecture, and we need, he understood, to come to an accommodation with nature rather than wishing for its utter eradication or for its total triumph. And he did, this is Alan Weisman, who wrote The World Without Us in 2007. Thomas imagined at times how the world would go on without us, but he also, in his war diary and his wider writings, began to dream of a way for nature to prosper that doesn't depend on our demise. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
I couldn't help reflecting on how beautiful post-apocalyptic Cambridge would look, but as one who works in the institution, I doubt if you could achieve such change in Cambridge University so rapidly. that was a wonderful account of how writers and artists have used ruins to speculate about the past and to comment on the present, and I'm sure I'm not alone in being grateful to have much deeper insight into and appetite for Edward Thomas, who I suppose, like many of us, I knew mostly for an elegant little poem about a halted train. It has, I think, been a privilege, in addition, to have so beautifully crafted a talk. Thank you very much indeed.